Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks' The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find everything that we record as part of The Learning College at vnnforum.com. You're welcome also to join us at pyvil.net, our social medium. Roughly similar to the Gab I used to mention until I was banned off there for such material as this, and Twitter. Anyway, we're going to pick up with Chapter 7, the penultimate. That means next to last chapter. This is the second segment we're doing out of Chapter 7. It'll be from page 269 to 288, and probably about five segments for the whole of Chapter 7, which is, we heard last time about Jewish, essentially the value that Jews place on intelligence and training or education, and the development of these massive volumes of hair-splitting argument over trivial or abstract things, just simply in order to develop the capacity to argue and to memorize great amounts of material and to deal with arguments. So let's resume on page 269. Jewish education among the Sephardim and Ashkenazim. In Ashkenaz, Germany, and most of the Ashkenaz were in Poland. It was actually where Jews grew large in population. It's Sephardic Jews, the Spanish-type Jews. Do not neglect the studies of the learned, but apply yourself to their maxims. From these you will learn discipline and how to be the servant of princes. Eccles 8:8. I was saying Ecclesiastes, but I'm suspecting that's from their own Talmud somewhere. A couple more epigraphs. The world endures only for the sake of the breath of school children. B. Shabbath 119b. It is better to give charity so that youngsters may study than to give charity to the synagogue. Motto of German Jewry in the medieval period, quoted in Knarrfogel 1992. MacDonald now. Religious study was of central importance among the Sephardic Jews in Spain. Parents were expected to provide education for their children, although elementary and secondary education was often supplemented by communal assessments, and the kehillah typically provided for Talmudic study. Quote, the motive was never lost sight of, that the study of the Torah was a religious precept for which no sacrifice was too great. Study of the complexities of the Mishnah and the Talmud began as early as age 7 or 8. Higher education in the Talmud and Jewish law was the province of the local rabbi, and there was great prestige attached to this role. The rector of the yeshiva was the living embodiment of their highest ideal. Outside the walls of the academy and the community at large, he was the custodian of Judaism and a regenerating moral and spiritual force among his people. He was a dominating moral figure in the community, and he wielded considerable legal powers. Neumann, 69. The scholar was free from communal taxes, and his government taxes were paid by the communal treasury. This special treatment was not because these scholars were impoverished, but occurred even if the scholar was wealthy, as a sign of reverence. The scholar was also protected from personal abuse by the use of harem, H-E-R-E-M, harem, ban, and fines, and he was accorded a prominent place of burial. These trends are also clear in the work on traditional Ashkenazi societies. During the medieval period, rabbinical rulings required fathers to hire a melamed, or a melamed, M-E-L-A-M-M-E-D. During the medieval times, rabbis ruled that fathers have to hire a melamed tutor for their sons, citing Knarrfogel, K-A-N-A-R-F-O-G-E-L, Fogel, V-O-G-E-L, means bird in German. Torah study was viewed as the noblest pursuit, same site. During this period, scholars, while not supported by the community as in Spain, were revered, and efforts were made to ensure that they would be able to make a living effortlessly. Thus, for example, Knarrfogel describes a ruling that scholars are allowed to retain monopolies in trade with Gentiles, while such monopolies are not allowed for other Jews. Quote, the community is mandated by Talmudic law to protect and aid this scholar whose work is the work of heaven and who teaches Torah without compensation in order that he not be distracted from his studies. By the 14th and 15th centuries, as the Ashkenazi communities became larger, formalized community support for scholars became the rule. Katz, writing of the 16th to 18th centuries, notes that all Jewish children were expected to obtain schooling at a heder, elementary school for children up to ages 12, 13. Remember John Hader, the one in the movie about the goofball in Iowa that was promoted by Joe Suckpoop Farah? What was that movie? I can't think. I want to say it. There was Yahoo Serious. That's what it was. His last name was Hader. So Hader is an elementary school for Jews, I guess. Let's see. All Jewish children were expected to obtain schooling at a Hader in the 16th to 1800, 15 to 1700. Elementary school up to 12, 13. Even those in remote villages and poor children, schooling occurred in public institutions under the supervision of the Kehillah. Remember, that's the Jews' self-government in exile. And the Kehillah, or the Kehillah, also supported the education of poor children. The Kehillot, in turn, were strongly pressured to maintain their educational institutions by super-Kehillah organizations, and small villages who could not afford a yeshiva were obligated to contribute to the support of those in larger towns. There was a keen interest in ensuring that the children actually made progress in school by having the rabbi make periodic examinations. There was also close supervision to ensure that there were not too many pupils per teacher, or that the teacher did not lower the hours of instruction or engage the children in extraneous pursuits. Zborowski and Herzog describe the custom of having the teacher visit on Sunday afternoon while the student was being quizzed by his father to determine his progress in school. For the teacher, it was an important moment because his livelihood depended on the performance of the child. Now, the key thing here is, among themselves, Jews don't tolerate bullshit. They know true from false. They know right from wrong. They know what's effective from what's bullshit, and they don't tolerate it, and they demand performance. But among us, they spread the exact opposite of what they spread among themselves, and this is just one of a thousand examples of that. Their kids have to demand that performance, whereas if you try to promote merit among the NEA, why, the media will attack you for being racist and this and that, because they don't want goyish children learning, because they see learning as important, and if goyish children learn, then they will compete with them. That's yet another subtle or second or tertiary reason they went after Germany, because nowhere else in the white world was learning as valued as in Germany. We have noted the historical importance, page 272, of a highly educated, wealthy elite for the fortunes of the entire Jewish community. So education and knowledge are key to their success of the whole Jewish community. And that's why one of the reasons they value scholars so highly. Corresponding to this circumstance, Jewish education among the Ashkenazim was highly elitist. The ultimate aim of education was to create scholars in Jewish law, and for this task, yeshivot were created. That's like the noun form with a T in the end, I guess. Like, teachers at the Hader level were poorly paid. While there was little prestige attached to this occupation, while the head of the yeshiva had immense prestige and was often wealthy and connected by marriage to other wealthy families. Katz, 61, makes the claim that education in the Hader was intended not so much to provide a broad basic education for the masses as to provide the minority of children who were capable an opportunity to study the Talmud. In this area of extreme importance, the free market reigned supreme. The rabbi who ran the yeshiva obtained his position solely via the approbation of the students and the scholars. Approbation meaning approval. Now again, this is kind of like Jefferson, you know, he set up these free public schools to try to find the meritorious ones, the best ones, and give the poor but able a chance they might not otherwise have. That's the theory, at least. And in Germany, as I was saying, like when I was over there, I mean, teaching at the gymnasium level, or like we'd say the high school level, to them is a huge thing. They might have PhDs doing it, people who know five or six languages, whereas in the U.S. it's not that big of a deal. Regarding the education received at the yeshivot, Katz, 61, states that the scholarship of yeshiva students reached such a stage of complexity and acuteness that no one who had not devoted several years to intensive study could follow a lecture on their level or a learned discussion between them. Argumentation was highly abstract and exaggerated casuistry called pill-pull. Pilpul is an important concept, hair splitting bullshit debate. Pilpul means hair, it's a Jewish term. You don't find that anywhere else. We would say debate, but it's very sort of expostulating. It sort of implies a style. It implies a dishonesty, and it implies a fineness that is not really useful in some way. It's basically you're arguing for argument's sake, but also to gain an edge and about things that are, it's not really honest, is basically what it comes down to. It was divorced from reality. So, you know, this would be perfect in defending leftism that you're promoting among the stupid goyim, right? This ability to twist words, to twist meanings. A perfect example was if you saw the debate between E. Michael Jones, the Catholic apologist, and Michael Brown, the racial Jew, convert to Christianity, twisting words. And what do you mean? Well, you can't refer to Jews as Jews. You can't use a collective term for them. He was saying, you have to say, well, these Jews and those Jews, but you can't just say Jews. This is a perfect example of Pilpul and dishonesty, casuistry, sophistry. But basically, these are dishonesty at a very granular level, let's say, in relation to argument. Divorced from reality, quote unquote. And this is the Jews admitting this about this. A major activity consisted of attempting to logically resolve contradictions in the Talmud by engaging in dialectical Talmudic discourses termed halukim. Consistent with the present, that might be a good one to vive up or revive. I've never seen it used, so we couldn't say revive, but to use in our right-wing discussion of what Jews do. Halukim, dialectical Talmudic discourses to resolve logical contradictions. Consistent with the present functionalist hypothesis, says MacDonald, it was activity that demanded, quote, penetration, scholarship, imagination, memory, logic, wit, subtlety. Advanced bullshit, basically, with the legal flavor. Zborowski and Herzog, 52. Besides the abstract casuistry, part of the school year, let's look that word up. Just to be sure what it is. Now, looking it up, it's slightly tricky. It's not clear how it differs from sophistry, which is sort of the use of clever arguments that are actually false. So casuistry basically means the same thing, but it particularly involves morality, and it comes from cases like trying to apply ethics to a particular case. To me, it could be wrong, but it means going wrongly either way. Either trying to reason someone out of something they did by means of bogus application of ethics, or extracting the wrong ethic from something and trying to turn it into something general as well. Now, a use of like casuistry, or something I've seen described as casuistry, it's a little hard to understand, but basically it's unsound reasoning that is used to deceive. In the case of sophistry and casuistry, and particularly pertaining to moral things with casuistry. So when they try to oppose Christians who speak in favor of traditional sexual knowledge and sexual behavior and practice and recommendations, they will say, well, Jesus or some other figure in the Bible, you're supposed to love. That's casuistry. They don't allow any other thing than they try to misapply this rule to a specific case and fool people. So it's all about fooling people, particularly with regard to morals and ethics. Casuistry. Now, let's see. Besides the abstract casuistry, and that would be applying the morals to some particular case. Part of the school year was devoted to developing a knowledge of the precise meaning and analysis of the Talmud. Katz, 61, notes that the method of precise analysis and the meaning of the early codifiers was also sufficiently complicated so that only several years' study would equip a person to follow such a course. Students who completed their studies and received the titles of Haver and Morinu, M-O-R-E-I-N-U, Haver, H-A-V-E-R, obtained a variety of privileges within the community, and the rabbi of the yeshiva, quote, could expect to gain prestige which would carry over to his other fields of economic activity. The honor accorded the rabbi as head of the yeshiva and as disseminator of learning among the people, values that were universally esteemed, strengthened his hand as he carried out his function as arbiter of the values of the entire community. Katz, 61. The Talmid Hakam, T-A-L-M-I-D-H-A-K-A-M, the scholar, in parentheses, the Talmid Hakam, scholar, was the living embodiment of the law, quote, the terrestrial realization of the divine image, from Sorkin, 87. Again, same, quote, study was identical with all of the religious virtues then, including morality, and being a scholar was a route to prestige and a good livelihood. Indeed, ranking within the traditional Eastern European shtetl community corresponded closely with scholarly ability, citing Zborowski and Herzog. Seating arrangements in the synagogue were an order of learning with the rabbi and other Mizrach as the most learned, nearest the eastern wall and next to the ark where the Torah was housed, while those near the western wall were the most illiterate, ignorant members of the community. Having illustrious scholarly was an important component of one's yichus, or family background, an essential aspect of social status in the community and known to all. While wealth could compensate for learning, a man with no money who was nevertheless learned could achieve the highest status. However, it was unlikely that such a learned man would remain poor, since he would be sought by wealthy men as a son-in-law. Contrast this with a goyim who value basically money over everything, except maybe athletic ability. Even very poor yeshiva students were accorded great respect because their prospects for wealth and high social status were good. Further, if a person with yichus lost his money, he was the object of a discreet charity, indicating that his pedigree continued to be a resource even during times of adversity. On the other hand, an illiterate Amoretz, A-M-O-R-E-T-S, from Am Ha'ares, meaning ignoramus, an illiterate ignoramus called Amoretz, was at the absolute bottom of the hierarchy, despised as not really a complete Jew. Zborowski and Herzog, in 52, showed that the dichotomy intellectual/non-intellectual was more or less coincident with Jew, non-Jew, and persons without intellectual ability were constantly confronted by the social superiority of those who had intellectual ability. Persons without intellectual ability were also morally suspected of being more likely to beat their wives engaging in other horrible deeds. And that's how they see goyim generally, rough, crude, insensitive, unethical, unintelligent, unlearned animals that need to be controlled by the government lest they lapse into their notorious and genetical anti-Semitism. So there's a residue of that feeling about their own untutored or lowest-ranking brethren. Parents scolded their recalcitrant children with the prospect that if they continued to fail to excel at scholarship, they would descend to the depths of being an Amoretz. Hundert, 92, shows that the income from rabbinic duties obtained by the rabbi of the small town of Opatow at the end of the 18th century placed him at the very top level of income for the entire community, below only the top estate managers. Goetain, 71, writing of the medieval Islamic period, shows that scholars were often the recipients of gifts from other Jews in distant countries. There is no question that Jews tended to be far more educated than the populations they lived among, and this was not only true in traditional societies. Even in the early stages of emancipation in Germany, Jewish families increasingly shifted to an emphasis on secular education as a means to ensure upward mobility and compete on equal terms with Gentiles. In 1933, citing Gordon, 84, despite consisting of less than 1% of the population, Jews comprised 25% of students in law and medicine and 34% of graduate students in philosophy. Even in grammar schools, Jewish children were overrepresented by a factor of over 6-1 in Berlin, which was a prominent theme of anti-Semitic rhetoric in Germany during this period. See chapter 5 and Separation and Its Discontents, chapter 2, turning to 275, Education and Eugenics Among Jews. Number of epigraphs. A man should sell all he possesses in order to marry the daughter of a scholar, or marry his daughter to a scholar or other man of character, because he may then rest assured that his children will be scholars. But marriage to an ignoramus will result in ignorant children. B. Pesachim 49a. For a learned man to marry the daughter of an ignoramus, Amharis, is like planting a vine tree among thorns. B. Pesachim 49a. If one sees that scholarship is dying out in his children, one should marry his son to the daughter of a learned man. Same Pesachim. An unlettered Israelite should not marry a woman of priestly descent, since this constitutes in a way a pound her and placed her in front of a lion, seeing that the beast's habit is to smite his mate and have intercourse with her, since he has no shame. A man should go so far as to sell all his possessions in order to marry a scholar's daughter, for he should die or go into exile, his children would grow up to be scholars. Similarly, he should marry his daughter to a scholar, since there is no reprehensible thing or strife in the house of a scholar. The Code of Maimonides, Book 5, The Book of Holiness, Chapter 21, 31-32, 140. Now, MacDonald, eugenicists such as Hughes, 1928, and Weyl, W-E-Y-L, 1963, have long emphasized Jewish eugenic practices as... From this perspective, not only did the Jewish canon perform an educational function, but also there is evidence that the Talmudic Academy often functioned as an arena of natural selection for intelligence. The first major eugenic effect occurred when the Babylonian exiles returned to Israel, now a part of the Persian Empire, in the 5th century BC, 500 years before Jesus. The Babylonian exiles returned to Israel. The Babylonian exiles were disproportionately wealthy compared to the former Israelites of the southern kingdom. The main reason given for this exclusion was that these groups had not preserved their ethnic purity, but Ezra's policy of removing all individuals of foreign taint from the Israelite community would also have had a eugenic effect. Dating the origins of eugenics as a conscious policy among Jews is difficult, says MacDonald. So we don't know exactly when they began eugenics. The evidence described in this chapter indicates that concern with education originated at least by the 2nd century BC, and there is evidence for social, economic, and genetic discrimination against the less educated classes at least from the period following the Second Commonwealth, 70 AD. Moore, 1927-30, see also Alon, 77, and Safre, 68, suggest that following the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, the new class division was between an educated, religiously observant elite called associates, the Havarim, like have and rim, Havarim, singular Haber, the Haber, i.e. members of the fellowship, and the Amhares, who are suspected of being careless in the performance of the religious law. So they're distinction between the Havarim and the Amharis, the idiots, the ignoramuses. Amharis, ignoramuses. Havarim, the higher ones. The appellation Amharis itself is significant since it is the term used for the racially mixed, religiously impure, native population invaded against by Ezra and Nehemiah during the Restoration in the 5th century B.C. It is thus a derogatory term, and the animosity between these groups was rather intense, especially during the 2nd century AD. Avi-Yonah, 1984, notes that after the destruction of the Second Temple, the highly observant, exclusive Habarim were the only group available to reconstitute a national authority, and they quickly assumed power as magistrates and used their authority to enforce rigorous observation of a very strict interpretation of the religious law, including the agricultural laws, which impacted so heavily on the Amharis, you know, the ignorant. The Jews associate ignorance with land and rurality, being rural, farm or a physical occupation. These all signify that you're not a scholar. And the scholars are the highest, the summum bonum, the maximum good in the community. So working with your hands, working in the fields, working with animals, all these things signify lower class to Jews. For example, during the economically difficult times of the 3rd century, the Habarim, I am is always a plural, strongly opposed the relaxation of the sabbatical year law, in which fields were to remain fallow in the 7th year, despite the hardship this caused to the Amharis, the poor rural ignoramuses. The rabbis had power in the towns, but they were freed from the taxes, while at the same time being dependent ultimately on the Amharis for support. The freedom from taxation was especially resented during economic crises, as during the 3rd century. The result was the development of an elite class of scholarly rabbis whose status was based on intellectual ability and who were supported by relatively illiterate and poor peasantry. There were a variety of methods of social discrimination against the Amhares. Amhares. I'm just going to say Amhares. The Amhares were ritually unclean, so that any contact with them was fraught with difficulty. For example, Mishnah Tractate Tohorot, or Tohorot, T-O-H-O-R-O-T, 7, 1-9, 8, 1-5, goes into great detail on how Amhares impart uncleanness to virtually everything they come in contact with, including the space surrounding them. Moore, 1927, summarizes these prohibitions by noting that, quote, "The presumption of uncleanness was a serious bar to social intercourse, and indeed to friendly relations of any kind. Because of their ignorance of the law, the Amhares may not have paid the requisite tithes on agricultural produce to the authorities, with the result that business relationships were also highly problematic. Moreover, the Amhares were prevented from testifying in legal proceedings, could not be entrusted with a secret, and could not be appointed guardian of an orphan or be in charge of the poor rates. During the economic troubles of the 3rd century, the patriarch only reluctantly and belatedly opened his storehouses to the Amhares after originally opening them to students of the Bible, of the Mishnah, of the Gemara, of the Halakha, and the Haggadah." Quoted in Avi Yonah, 1984. These comments indicate that the policies of the Havarim would have had negative economic effects on the Amhares, and the social discrimination might reasonably suppose to result in defection to the Amhares from Judaism. Of particular importance or interest here is that marriage between the two classes was condemned in terms of abhorrence. More, thus the Talmud states that a Jew must not marry a daughter of an Amhares because they are unclean animals. Shekis, basically, I guess that's the same as Shigis, spelled differently. And they're women forbidden reptiles, Sheris, from Shiksa, I suppose, or related. Or if they're saying this about their own lower class, let alone Goyim, or maybe these became Goyim, or they spun off. And with respect to their daughters, the scripture writes, "Cursed be he that lieth with any manner of beast," Deuteronomy 27:21. Said R. Eleazar, "One may butcher an Amhares on a day of atonement that happens to fall on the Sabbath, when any kind of work constitutes a violation of a double prohibition. His disciples said to him, 'Master, say slaughter instead of the vile word butcher.'" You slaughter human and butcher an animal. "But he replied, 'Slaughtering requires a benediction. Butchering does not require a benediction.'" B. Pesachim 49b. In the words of Hillel, "No ignorant man, Amhares, is religious," cited in Moore in 1927-30. Being religious meant having knowledge of an enormously complicated code of laws, many of which, quote, "from our point of view, seem of the smallest religious significance." That's Moore again. "Thus, a great deal is made of the regulations on agricultural tithing to the priest," that's paying a tenth, the tithing means tenth, comes from tenth, "perhaps because many of them, the Amhares, were peasants, even though the priest no longer had any religious function. There is an extraordinary interest in the Mishnah, in the regulation and taxation of agriculture, resulting in thousands of regulations." You know, one third of a year, then the rabbi still gets his, you know, X percentage, that type of thing. "Regarding the general system of agricultural implicated, while the method of collection, so far as there was such a thing, had the semblance and doubtless the substance of extortion by the beneficiary. Block quote here. It is small wonder that the peasant earned the reputation of being very untrustworthy in acquitting himself of his religious obligations in this sphere. Even the most scrupulous of the class doubtless followed in this as in other matters the prescriptive usage of their fathers, heedless of the stricter interpretation of these laws in the schools and the refinements of the oral law. Citing Moore. The clear and Moore, 1927-30. The clear animosity between these groups, the emphasis on elaborate regulation of the economic behavior of the Amhares by an intellectual and non-agricultural elite, the elaborate set of rules regulating social contact between the groups based on the uncleanness of the Amhares, at least during the first century. Minimally, there is the suggestion that marriage would only be within group, and even after the disappearance of this class distinction, only wealthy, intelligent Amhares would be able to have influence in the towns and connubium with the rabbinic class. That's sexual congress. Moreover, it is apparent from this material that the Amhares would have had maximum motivation to leave the group. It has been mentioned that the poor and obscure have always been the most likely to leave Judaism, and this must have been particularly so during this period. From an evolutionary perspective, the exclusionary behavior and economic disabilities imposed on the Amhares by eugenics among the Jews. The Talmuds show a strong concern with eugenics. Marriage with a scholar or his children is highly recommended. Quote, for marriage, a scholar was regarded as more eligible than the wealthy descendant of a noble family. That's how highly they rated scholars. The Tanaim did not tire of reiterating the advice that, quote, under all circumstances, should a man sell everything he possesses in order to marry the daughter of a scholar, as well as to give his daughter to a scholar in marriage. Never should he marry the daughter of an illiterate man. That's a direct quote from Barron, 1952b. Feldman, 1939, shows that the authors of the Talmud, like the other ancients, believed that heredity made an important contribution to individual differences in a wide variety of traits, including physical traits, e.g. height, personality, but not moral character, and, as indicated by the above quotations, contemplating marriage are enjoined to attend to the family history of the future spouse. Look into the pedigree of who you're considering marrying. Quote, a girl with a good pedigree, even if she be poor and an orphan, is worthy to become the wife of a king. From Midrash Num R. 5, quoted in Feldman, 1939. A prospective wife should be scrutinized for the presence in her family of diseases believed to be inherited, e.g. epilepsy, and also the character of her brother should be examined, suggesting an awareness of the importance of sex-linked factors. Physical appearance was not to be a critical resource for a woman. Quote, for false is grace and beauty is vain. Pay regard to good breeding, for the object of marriage is to have children. Tanith 26b and 31a, quoted in Feldman, 1939. Feldman interprets the Tzitza marriage not made according to eugenic principles. A barrel of fruit was broken in the marketplace in order to call attention to the event, and the following words spoken. Quote, listen ye, our brethren, A.B. married an unworthy wife, and we fear lest his offspring mingle with ours. Take ye therefore an example for generations to come, that his offspring may never mix with ours. In his authoritative 12th century compilation of Jewish law, Maimonides states that a woman belonging to a family of lepers or epileptics, provided that there is a presumption based on three cases that the disease is hereditary with them. That's from the Code of Maimonides, Book 5, the Book of Holiness, Chapter 21. The advice, therefore, in the Sephardic community was to carefully scrutinize the family of a prospective mate for heritable diseases, and there is an implicit theory that the more commonly the disease is found among family members, the more likely it is to be heritable, advice that makes excellent sense from the standpoint of modern genetics. These writings were not without practical effect. There is evidence that the practice of intermarriage between daughters of wealthy men and males with high ability and scholarship dates from the very origins of Judaism as a diaspora religion. Barron, 1952b, notes that in Talmudic times, wealthy men selected promising scholars as sons-in-law and supported them in their years of study. Interestingly, Johnson, 87, notes that most Jews during medieval times could list at least seven generations of ancestors. The main purpose of the genealogy was to show that one had illustrious scholars in one's lineage, and the list usually began with a famous scholar. Maimonides himself listed four important scholar judges as ancestors. The implication is that having illustrious scholars in one's pedigree was an important resource in social interactions within the Jewish community. These practices also occurred among the Ashkenazim from an early period. Grossman, 1989, notes that in medieval Germany it was the custom among yeshiva heads, themselves members of distinguished families, to choose their best pupils as sons-in-law. The son-in-law would then succeed him in his leadership within the community. In the shtetl societies of Eastern Europe, the Talmudic commandment to attempt to marry a scholar was taken very seriously, to the point that there was a very direct correlation between the amount of dowry and the number of scholars in the family tree. Citing Zborowski and Herzog, 1952, a block quote, "Parents dream of marrying their daughter to a learned youth or their son to the daughter of a learned father. The matchmaker, who is a very important institution in the shtetl, has in his notebook a list of all the eligible boys and girls within range. Under each name is a detailed account of his yichus, family social standing, in which the most important item is the number of learned men in the family, past and present. The greater the background of learning, the better the match." There was also a concern with mental disorders in the genealogy of prospective mates in traditional shtetl society, and at least until very recently, among Hasidic Jews in contemporary New York. A person with a psychiatric disorder was a blot on the marriage prospects of the entire family for generations, with the result that families made every effort to prevent psychiatric disorders from being known to the wider community. There is also very clear evidence for eugenic practices among the 19th century Ashkenazim. Etkes, E-T-K-E-S, 89, finds that, although a variety of traits were important in the choice of sons-in-law, including appearance, health, and temperament, particular value was placed on the perceived potential for Torah study. In other words, marriage with the daughter of a wealthy man and consequent support of study during the years of adolescence, the Kest period, K-E-S-T, were conditioned primarily on scholarly ability, and indeed the prospective father-in-law would give the future son-in-law an examination prior to agreeing to the marriage. The father-in-law would then support the couple for a specified period of years and provide a large dowry, which would secure the financial future of the couple. Katz, 61, shows that scholarly ability was the summum bonum, top good, within the Jewish community, the ultimate resource when contemplating marriage. Wealthy individuals who were not themselves scholars could obtain scholarship indirectly by providing large dowries so that their daughters could marry scholars. Quote, "If an unlettered person married into a family of scholars, he would bask in the reflection of their glory." Moreover, in some cases, scholars could become wealthy simply as a result of their incomes and the many gifts they received. Individuals, such as the court Jews of the 17th and 18th centuries, provided gifts and support for scholars. They thereby developed, quote, "the reputation of cherishing the Torah," and the merit so acquired was equivalent to that achieved by study itself. So the best was to be a scholar, but if you've just funded it, that would bring you much social status and honor, too. Beginning in the ancient world, wealthy men would marry their daughters to promising scholars and support the couple until adulthood, Barron 52. This practice became a religiously sanctioned policy and persisted among both the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim. Katz, 61, notes that this pattern of early marriage and the associated period of prolonged was assured only to the wealthy. Quote, "Only members of the upper class who were outstanding in both wealth and learning could afford the luxury of an early match without lessening their prospects. They were assured of a good match by their very position. The poor, even when allowed to marry, would be forced to marry later, and there was a group of both sexes that was forced to remain unmarried, a clear marker of sexual competition within the Jewish community. On the other hand, upwardly mobile individuals would often defer marriage until they had obtained status, whether in the business world or by developing a reputation as a scholar. As noted in Chapter 6, there's a positive association between wealth and numbers of children in the Jewish households in the 18th century, and Weinrib notes that there were marked differences in fertility among Jews, with successful business leaders, prominent rabbis, and community leaders having a large number of children reach adulthood, while families of the poor were small. So they're doing the exact opposite of what the American system does. The American government subsidizes the very worst, and the Jew system subsidizes the very best, the richest, and the best scholars. You see? And that's what eugenics means in practice. Someone's looking out for the whole group. They're trying to increasingly have better, higher, more of the better, less of the worse. So they're doing it correctly. Katz notes that because the Ashkenazim were prevented from placing their resources in land, and because their capital was always precarious, since it was liable to expropriation by the authorities, there was an unusual degree of fluidity in this society in terms of both upward and downward mobility. In this type of society, scholarship was a better criterion of resource obtaining potential even than present wealth, since it was independent of time and place, and obtaining a scholarly reputation was certainly not a matter of good fortune, as wealth sometimes was. However, in some ways, scholarship and wealth were interchangeable, since property qualifications for voting were waived for scholars, another indication of the many benefits that scholarship conferred within. Nevertheless, there was a strong overlap among wealth, scholarship, family connections, and political power within the community, to the point that at times, scholarly position was virtually inherited. Knarfogel, 92, notes that virtually all of the prominent French Tosafists in the 12th and 13th century were in a direct line from Rashi, or were the sons-in-laws in this direct line. The presence of sons-in-law in this genealogy shows the possibility of upward mobility. It was a society with, quote, tremendous distances between its peaks and valleys. He who aimed to reach the peak had a long, steep road to climb, but if he had the strength, the ability, and the will, nothing would prevent him from achieving his desire. Katz. Another aspect of some eugenic importance is that poor Jews were relatively likely to become apostates. Such defections would also contribute to the skewing of the Jewish gene pool toward high intelligence and resource acquisition ability. This phenomenon may quite possibly be related not only to the relatively degraded in synagogue elections. These practices continued for many years thereafter, and indeed, Meyer 88 notes that, to working people, the established synagogue in the first decades of the century often looked more like a rich man's institution, allied with oppressive capital, than one where they felt at home. Meyer 88 describes membership in Reform congregations in the 30s as a status symbol and as a marker of economic success. Extreme concern with worldly success has also remained a characteristic of Judaism in the contemporary world. Hertz and Rosen, 82, note that success is so vitally important to the Jewish family ethos that we can hardly overemphasize it. We cannot hope to understand the Jewish family without understanding the place that success for men, and recently women, plays in the system. Success is measured in terms of intellectual achievement, social status, and money, while failure, e.g. to graduate from college, is viewed as a problem requiring clinical counseling. Not surprisingly, a recent survey indicated that the group least likely to defect from Judaism was the highly educated, Elman 87. And that's where we're going to leave it today, because if we get on to a different subject from here, page 288. Don't know if I said 289 earlier, but anyway, so basically your takeaway there is that Jews see scholarship as number one, and everything flows from that. So they know how to talk. They can out-talk or think they can out-talk anyone on earth. They refine this. They hone this by, you know, and the iron sharpens iron sense by arguing in all their various schools. And you have to give money. You have to marry into these scholarly families. If you're a rich businessman, give money to the scholars. If you're not a scholar, we'll try to marry into them, try to become a scholar. If you're poor, you know, they look down on you and they basically either get rid of you or force you to get better. So very, very eugenic, very pro-racial, pro-community. And what are whites by comparison? And that's the question I'll leave you with. Thanks for being with me today. I've been Alex Linder, reading to you A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Out of That, by Kevin MacDonald, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy. And we'll be back later for more from Chapter 7.